Chapter 5. Among the Universalists. My connection with the Mahabodhi Society went back to the early months of 1947, when, shortly after discharging myself from the army, I stayed for a month or more at the headquarters building and helped with office work. The sun was setting on the Raj. Lord Mountbatten had just succeeded Lord Wavell as Viceroy, and the date for the handover of power to an independent India and an independent Pakistan was soon to be advanced to midnight of the 14th of August. During the war years, the Society had kept a low profile, mainly on account of its pre-war links with Japan. But even though hostilities had now ceased, the shabby, neglected headquarters building showed little sign of renewed religious activity. The Sinhalese bhikkhu in charge, who insisted on being styled His Holiness the High Priest, spent more time dabbling in municipal politics than in spreading the Dharma, so that eventually, disgusted with the worldly, unspiritual atmosphere of the place, I left Calcutta in the hope of finding less arid pastures elsewhere. Not surprisingly, I left with a decidedly negative impression of the Mahabodhi Society. This impression was reinforced 2 years later at Sarnath, the site of the Buddha's first sermon, when, having spent the intervening period as a freelance wandering ascetic, I asked the bhikkhus who ran the society's centre there for ordination as a novice monk. My request was not only turned down with flimsy excuses that were no better than lies, I was treated with suspicion and hostility, and made to feel that anyone who went barefoot and refrained from handling money, as I then did, must be out of his mind. Nonetheless, a year and a half later, those same bhikkhus were happily participating in my higher ordination, while I myself was staying on my way to Sarnath from Kalimpong, as well as on the way back, at the Calcutta headquarters building. The fact was that the Mahabodhi Society was effectively the only Buddhist organisation in India, so that if one was in any way concerned with the revival of Buddhism in the land of its birth, one could hardly avoid being involved with it. Moreover, Devapriya Valensina, the General Secretary of the Society, had recently returned to Calcutta from Ceylon, where he had spent the war years. And with his arrival on the scene, the society had begun to emerge from its state of suspended animation. Soon he and I were in correspondence, and I had not only organised the reception given by the Buddhists of Kalimpong to the sacred relics of Shariputra and Moggallana, which Valensina had recovered from the Victoria and Albert Museum, but had been invited to join the delegations accompanying the relics to Sikkim and Nepal. Finally, Valensina had asked me to write a biographical sketch of Anagarika Dhammapala, the founder of the Mahabodhi Society, for inclusion in the Diamond Jubilee souvenir that he was planning to bring out. And during the autumn of the previous year, I had spent several weeks with him in Calcutta for this purpose. The writing of the biographical sketch brought about a change in my connection with the society, indeed in my attitude towards it. Before writing the sketch, I knew little more about Dhammapala than that he was a Sinhalese, that he had sought to wrest the Mahabodhi temple at Bodh Gaya, the site of the Buddha's enlightenment, from Hindu ownership and control, and that, besides reviving Sarnath as a centre of Buddhist pilgrimage, he had succeeded in awakening interest in Buddhism among a section of the English-educated intelligentsia, especially in Calcutta. But as I went through his diaries and read the articles he had written for early issues of the Mahabodhi Journal, I came to realise that Dhammapala was not just an organiser and activist, as I had hitherto supposed, but also a yogi and ascetic with an intense inner life. I came to realise too that the Mahabodhi Society I had encountered in 1947 and even later bore little resemblance to the Mahabodhi Society that had existed in Dhammapala's time and that could, with Valentina's arrival on the scene, conceivably exist again. Moreover, I had observed, in the course of my 2 months at the headquarters building, the longest period I had yet spent there, that a covert and unacknowledged struggle for control of the society was going on between Valentina and his supporters on the one hand, and on the other, Jinnaratana, the high priest, and the opportunist elements he had introduced into society, and even into its governing body, during Valentina's prolonged absence in Ceylon. As Dharmapala's personal disciple and recognized successor, as well as General Secretary for Life, Valentina was probably in the stronger position. But Jinnaratana's resourcefulness and cunning were not to be underestimated. I therefore decided to throw my weight, such as it was, into the balance on the side of the real Mahabodhi Society and give Valentina whatever help and support I could. The result was that on my return to Kalimpong, the Young Men's Buddhist Association, brackets India, which I had founded in 1950, became the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, with me as bhikkhu in charge, while the following autumn, Valentina wrote inviting me to move down to Calcutta and relieve him of the burden of editing the Mahabodhi Journal. I was willing to relieve him of his burden. I was not willing to move down to Calcutta. Further correspondence ensued. In the end, it was agreed that I should edit the monthly from Kalimpong, but that I should come down to Calcutta and bring out my first 2 numbers from there. This would enable Valentina to hand over to me properly, besides enabling us to work out the logistics of producing a magazine that was being edited in a place 300 miles away from the place where it was printed, published, and distributed. Thus it was that I came to be visiting Calcutta again, this time with Sanchin, and again staying at the headquarters building, in the same corner room in which, a year earlier, I had written my biographical sketch. My companion and I were not long in setting up a sort of routine. We had breakfast together, sometimes at a restaurant, the society's standard breakfast of tea and 2 slices of toast being not always sufficiently substantial, if one had been fasting since noon the previous day, as I at least had been, after which I saw Sanchin onto a bus or tram and returned to the headquarters building. In the evening, if he was back in time from whichever of his relatives he had been visiting that day, we went out for a stroll, lingering over the second-hand bookstalls, and finishing up, more often than not, in a restaurant, where he could have a non-vegetarian meal and I a cup of very indifferent coffee. During the day, I read, wrote letters, and worked on the proposals for the improvement of the Mahabodhi Journal, which, at Valentina's suggestion, I had started drafting. Some days there was a puja or other religious ceremony to attend in the temple, as it was called, which occupied the first floor of the Sri Dharma Rajika Vihara, and was connected with the corresponding floor of the headquarters building by a little covered bridge. When I wanted a change from reading and writing, I talked to the other occupants of the building, especially to my brother monks, most of whom I met, in any case, at our anti-meridian lunch, which, in accordance with Theravadin custom, we took separately from the laity. Dharmaratana and Saratha, who both came from Ceylon, were already known to me, as was the Bengali monk Silabhadra. Dharmaratana's dark face always wore an apologetic smile. Quiet and studious by nature, and as sluggish in movement as he was slow of speech, he was a member of the editorial board of the Mahabodhi Journal, and sometimes helped with proofreading. Though he had been a monk for 20 or more years, he was still technically a novice, and for reasons I never succeeded in fathoming, steadfastly refused to take the higher ordination that would make him a bhikkhu. Saratha, who was much better known to me, was a very different kind of person. Bright-eyed and bustling, and so small he was known as the Little Monk. He was as talkative as Dhammaratana was taciturn, a great reader of Sinhalese newspapers, and a science student at one of the local colleges. "Does an amoeba have karma?" he had asked me the first time we met, to which I replied, "Does an amoeba have consciousness?" in brackets, chetana. And such exchanges had since become customary between us. I enjoyed his company more than I did that of the other monks, the more especially as he was a mine of information about Ceylon and Sinhalese Buddhism. Silabhadra, whom I knew only slightly, had taken the robe late in life after a career at the bar. Even now there was, I sometimes thought, more of the lawyer about him than the bhikkhu. A monk I had not met before was Aniruddha, the only son of wealthy, string-pulling Mrs. Munasinghe, a lady whose ambition it was to paint the Mahabodhi temple at Bodh Gaya bright yellow, and great-nephew of Anagarika Dharmapala. Though it was rumoured that he was being groomed to succeed Valasinha as General Secretary, the tall, almost hulking young man showed no sign of harbouring any such aspirations, or even of taking much interest in the affairs of the society. Quiet and unassuming, he showed greater interest in making friends not just with me, but also with Sachin, and more than once accompanied us to Hindustan Building, where he soon was so much at home with Sachin's aunts and female cousins that I started wondering if he was not better suited to family life than to monastic life. Perhaps it was a case of the mother seeking to realise her spiritual, or at least socio-religious, ambitions through the son. The only brother monk to whom I did not talk when I wanted to change from reading and writing, though I had known him longer than I had known anyone else in the building, was Jinnaratana, the high priest. Nor did he go out of his way to talk to me. The reappearance, as a member of the monastic order, of the same young Englishman who had been the witness of some of his un-monk-like, not to say un-Buddhist, behaviour back in 1947, had given him a nasty jolt, and though I was careful not to allude to the past, and though in the course of my previous visit much of the awkwardness between us had been dispelled, he was still not quite at ease with me. He may even have remembered telling me on more than one occasion, "You'll see, within 2 years I shall be General Secretary of the Society." Whether he remembered or not, he was still only one of the two joint secretaries. The other was Bhikkhu in charge of the Society's Sarnath Centre, and no nearer to the General Secretaryship than he had been 6 years earlier. If anything, he was further from it than ever. Contrary to his expectations, Valasinha had returned. He had returned and stayed. And during the 12 months that had elapsed since my last visit, Dhammapala's conscientious, hard-working disciple and successor, besides strengthening his position relative to that of the aspiring high priest, had contrived to bring about certain changes in society, changes that went some way towards making it a more truly Buddhist organisation. The biggest change was one whose significance was largely symbolic. As I was already aware, 6 months earlier, the society had acquired a new president. What was more, the new president was a Buddhist. That a Buddhist society should have a Buddhist president might seem nothing out of the ordinary. Surely it was axiomatic that such a society, especially one that had been founded expressly to revive Buddhism in India, and whose journal had for masthead the Buddha's exhortation to his disciples to go forth and preach the Dharma. would no more have a non-Buddhist for president than a Christian religious body would have a non-Christian at the helm of its affairs, or a Muslim religious body a non-Muslim. In the case of the Mahabodhi Society, it was apparently not axiomatic. The three previous presidents of the society, whose 10 years between them covered a period of nearly 40 years, had all been Bengali Brahmins, the third being in fact the son of the first. Some Buddhists and sympathisers with Buddhism outside the society were surprised, even outraged, by such a state of affairs. "Why does your Mahabodhi Society have a Bengali Brahmin for its president?" the ex-untouchable leader Dr. Ambedkar had demanded belligerently in the course of our first meeting only a year earlier. Himself an ex-untouchable, Bhimrao Ramjeeb Ambedkar had spent a lifetime fighting to liberate his people from the social, economic and religious disabilities imposed upon them by the caste Hindus, particularly the Brahmins. And to him it was incredible that an organisation dedicated to spreading the teachings of the Compassionate One should have a Brahmin for its president. Adding insult to injury from his point of view was the fact that the society's Bengali Brahmin president, Syama Prasad Mukherjee, was also president of the Bharatiya Jana Sangh, a right-wing Hindu political party, and an old political opponent of his. I therefore hastened to assure him that it was not my Mahabodhi Society. Though happy to help the society in whatever way I could, I had just written my biographical sketch of Anagarika Dhammapala, I did not actually belong to it, mainly on account of its having a Brahmin for president, and because its governing body was dominated by caste Hindus who had no real interest in Buddhism. Moreover, some of the Buddhist members of the society were as dissatisfied with the present state of affairs as he was, and both they and I hoped that before long we would have an opportunity of doing something about it. The opportunity had come sooner than I, or Ambedkar, or anyone else could have expected. In May, Syama Prasad Mukherjee, who was opposed to the Congress government's policy in Jammu and Kashmir, entered the state without a permit, was arrested and held in custody, fell ill a month later, and died the day after being admitted to hospital. This dramatic development left the Mahabodhi Society in need of a new president. There were two candidates. One was the Maharaj Kumar, or Crown Prince of Sikkim, who was a Mahayana Buddhist. The other was Dr. Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, Vice President of India and historian of Indian philosophy, who was a Telugu Brahmin from Andhra. Canvassing was vigorous, with the Buddhist members of the governing body tending to support the Maharaj Kumara's candidature, while their Hindu colleagues tended to support that of Dr. Radhakrishnan, partly because he was a Hindu, admittedly a very scholarly one, and partly on account of his occupying high political office. Valisina was determined that the Maharaj Kumar should be elected, and to this end had recourse to a tactic which, though perfectly constitutional, had not been tried before, and which no one would, in fact, have credited the normally shy, retiring little General Secretary with possessing either the imagination to devise or the boldness to execute. The tactic was based on the fact that the bhikkhus working for and supported by the society, of which there were hardly more than a dozen in the whole of India, were ipso facto members of the governing body. Normally they did not attend its meetings. They did not attend them because they could not afford to do so on the pittance they received from the society, and because the governing body, or rather its Hindu-dominated rump, the members of which all lived in Calcutta, refused to pay their travelling expenses. What Valisina did was to write to the bhikkhus, urging them to attend the crucial meeting at which the new president was to be elected, and undertaking to meet their travelling expenses out of his own pocket, The exercise had cost him 2,000 rupees, he told me with a rueful smile, and he would not be able to repeat it. Figures in various shades of yellow and orange were therefore able to descend on Calcutta from Sarnath, Bombay, Delhi, Madras and elsewhere to attend the crucial meeting and to vote for the Maharaj Kumar, with the result that, Buddhists being for once in the majority, the society now had a president who was a Buddhist. The only yellow-robed figure not to vote for the Maharaj Kumar was Jinnaratana. Accustomed as they were to having things their own way, the Hindu members of the governing body, save for two or three non-Bengalis who were friends and supporters of fellow sinners, were shocked and dismayed by their failure to secure the election of Dr. Radhakrishnan. They had been as determined to secure his election as Valasina had been to secure that of the Maharaj Kumar. Such was their determination that, on getting wind of the little General Secretary's tactics, they had not scrupled to spread scurrilous stories about the Maharaj Kumar in order to undermine support for his candidature. Alarmed, Valasina had written to me asking if the stories were true, as Kalimpong was next door to Sikkim, and I might be supposed to have my ear to the ground. And I had replied that, to the best of my knowledge, they were not. Support for the Maharaj Kumar's candidature thus remained firm, and to the shock and dismay of the Hindu members of the governing body, he was elected. So shocked and dismayed had they been, that after the meeting they had rounded on the victorious Buddhists, so Valasina told me, and accused them of narrow-mindedness, bigotry and sectarianism in wanting to have a Buddhist as president of the society. Their reaction did not surprise me. Hindus were universalists. For them, all religions were one. All paths led to the same goal. So it was a matter of comparative indifference whether the head of a Buddhist organization happened to be a Buddhist or a Hindu. Indeed, as Hindus possessed innately a far deeper knowledge of Buddhism or of any other religion than its own professed adherents, it was actually better that a Buddhist organization should be headed by a Hindu rather than a Buddhist. But Buddhism is in our blood, Hindu friends would insist when I attempted to correct their misunderstandings of Buddhist doctrine, meaning that they had the ability to understand Buddhism without necessity of actual study, simply by virtue of the fact that they had been born and brought up in India. I was not a universalist. I did not believe that all religions were one, or that all paths led to the same goal, and I had therefore been heartily glad 6 months earlier to hear that it was the Maharaj Kumar of Sikkim and not Dr. Radhakrishnan, who had been elected president of the Mahabodhi Society. Not that I had anything against his Bengali Brahmin predecessors. All three were very distinguished men. One was an educationist, another the Chief Justice of Bengal, while the third, the Maharaj Kumar's immediate predecessor, was an educationist come politician. But although they may have been prudent managers of the society's finances and have imparted to it a degree of acceptability among the Bengali intelligentsia, the fact that they were not themselves Buddhists meant that they were incapable of providing the spiritual leadership a Buddhist organization needed if it was to fulfill its function and be an effective vehicle for the dissemination of the Buddha's teaching. To what extent the Maharaj Kumar will be able to fulfil this function remained to be seen. But in the headquarters building, at least, a new spirit was already astir, and I felt happier to be living and working there than I had done the previous year. The only person in the building untouched by the new spirit was Jinnaratana. He continued to lurk in the shadows, so to speak, ready to strike down any friend or supporter of Falasina who was foolish enough to give him the opportunity. Eventually one did. Though conscious of his dark, brooding presence at the edge of the bright space that had opened within the society, I did not allow myself to be disturbed, and every day relieved Falasina of a little more of the burden of editing the Mahabodhi Journal. I had relieved him of the greater part of it when my daily routine and Sachin's received an unwelcome interruption. Sachin was taken ill. At first it seemed to me nothing more serious than an attack of malaria, probably caught in Shantiniketan. Dr. Soft, the Society's honorary physician, a septuagenarian Punjabi in the coarse white homespun of the Orthodox Gandhian, whom I immediately called in, prescribed Comequin tablets, as well as rest and liquid diet, and told me there was nothing to worry about. 3 days later, however, Sachin's temperature having in the meantime fluctuated dramatically, his pulse was so low that Dr. Soft started suspecting that it might be either influenza or typhoid and changed the prescription accordingly. He also warned me that the patient had to be kept absolutely quiet. This was easier said than done. Not that Sanchin himself was any problem. Like good deeds in the medieval morality play, he was sore bound, not by his sins indeed, but by sickness, and, quote, could not stir, unquote. The problem was the various female cousins who sat on his bed talking to him for so long, sometimes for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, that he was quite worn out. As they were relatives, I did not like to ask them to leave. They were quite impervious to hints, especially as I had not told Sachin how serious his condition might be and did not want him to know. Altogether, it was a worrying time. All I could do for the sufferer, apart from taking his temperature and giving him his medicine every 2 hours and soup at similar intervals, was to make him as comfortable as I could and keep Dr. Soft informed about developments by telephone. In between, I wrote letters and read proofs, leaving Sachin's bedside only to shop for him and, one evening, to give a lecture in the Society's lecture hall downstairs. This was the first of the weekly lectures Falasina had asked me to give, and whether by accident or design, the date of the lecture was the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, and my topic, Buddhism and God. After more than a week in bed, Sachin started to recover. He had not had typhoid, though he may have had influenza. And when his temperature and pulse had been normal for 3 days running, I judged him well enough to get up and go for a stroll in College Square. Here we sat on a bench for half an hour, at the foot of a pedestal that had lost its statue, enjoying the winter sunshine, and doing our best to ignore the unrestrained curiosity of the Bengali passers-by, some of whom stopped dead in their tracks in order to take a better look at us. A few days later, Dr. Soft having pronounced him out of danger, my companion was again spending the greater part of his time visiting relatives, while I continued easing myself, as I thought, into the editorial chair of the Mahabodhi Journal. I was no stranger to the pages of that publication. Articles, book reviews, and poems of mine had been appearing in the Society's Journal of International Buddhist Brotherhood, as it styled itself, for the last few years, and since July I had been contributing a monthly column entitled In the Light of the Dhamma, under the pseudonym of Himavantavasi. Himavantavasi, the dweller in the snowy mountains, the name had been found for me by Anandji, was a Buddhist hermit living in the Himalayas. He had no direct contact with the outside world, but reports of what was going on there, especially in the Buddhist part of it, somehow reached his ears from time to time, and In the Light of the Dhamma represented his reactions to what he heard. It was the first time I had written under a pseudonym, and from a literary point of view at least, the experience was an interesting one. Though the views to which I gave expression were very much my own, the manner in which I gave expression to them was not, in the sense that it was not quite the manner in which I would have expressed them had I been writing under my own name. Himavantavasi was not so much a pseudonym as a mask. The mask represented a character whom I had imagined, but who was so real to me that whenever I sat down to write my column, I became Himavantavasi. The mysterious dweller in the snowy mountains was an extension of my own personality, through which I could say things in a way in which I could not otherwise have said them, and through whom, therefore, I could experience myself in a way I could not otherwise have done. Himavantavasi enabled me to be myself more fully. Not that I wanted to be myself in the subjective, individualistic sense of that phrase. What I wanted was to give expression to my views, views which I hoped were genuinely Buddhist, and to give expression to them in as many different ways as possible. I therefore intended to go on writing my column even as editor of the Mahabodhi Journal. Indeed, as I settled myself more firmly into the editorial chair in the last days of the old year and the first days of the new, I was planning to give Himavantavasi a stablemate. I was preparing to don another mask, the first person plural using mask of the editor, and to write each month one or more editorials. Through this mask, too, I would give expression to my views, but I would give expression to them not in the naive manner of the dweller in the snowy mountains, but in the weightier, more authoritative manner appropriate to the official organ of a society that was, after all, both the leading Buddhist organisation in India and the best-known Buddhist organisation in the world. Hitherto, there had been no editorials in the Mahabodhi Journal. Yet there were numerous issues to which it ought to be drawing the attention of Buddhists, both inside and outside of India. Was not the ancient Buddhist site of Nagarjunakonda in the newly created Andhra state about to be totally submerged under a government irrigation scheme, despite the protests of historians and archaeologists? And had not Dr. B.C. Roy, the Chief Minister, categorically refused to declare Vaishakha Purnima a public holiday in West Bengal, even though the Union authorities had recently declared it a central government holiday? Hardly had my editorials on these issues been sent to the press, however, than I met with a serious disappointment. I would not be occupying the editorial chair of the Mahabodhi Society after all. In fact, there was no editorial chair for anyone to occupy. Instead, there was an editorial settee, into which seven or eight persons, myself included, were to be squeezed. There was to be an editorial board. In theory, there was already an editorial board, and it was precisely because the other members of the board invariably left all the work to him that Valasinha wanted me to relieve him of the burden of editing the Society's journal. Nonetheless, when the little General Secretary proposed at the governing body's first monthly meeting of the year that I should be formally appointed editor, his proposal was met with fierce opposition from the Hindu members, and it was with the greatest difficulty that, aided by two or three friends and supporters, he had got them to agree even to my being a member of the newly constituted editorial board. The reason for this opposition on the part of the Hindu members of the governing body was not far to seek. I was critical of certain aspects of Hinduism, particularly the caste system, and made no attempt to conceal my views. This had led to their dubbing me anti-Hindu. They were, of course, universalists, in whose eyes to be critical in any way of other religions, with the possible exception of Islam, was to be intolerant, and intolerance was the unforgivable sin.
that I was anti-Hindu was a fact that had been confirmed for them a few months earlier by a review I wrote of a new translation of Tulsidas' Rama Charita Manasa, a review Vallisinna had published in the Mahabodhi Journal. The 16th century Tulsidas, the servant of the sacred Basil, was a great poet. His retelling of the story of the hero King Rama, one of the avatars of the god Vishnu, was a classic of Hindi literature, and the Bible of the Hindi-speaking people of Hindu northern India. But Tulsidas was also an orthodox Brahmin. His perfervidly devotional apostrophes to Vishnu Rama were mingled with repeated references to Brahmins as the Buddhadevas, or earthly divinities. A Brahmin was to be worshipped, even though he possessed all the vices, whereas a Shudra, however virtuous, was to be despised. Though conceding that the poem undoubtedly contained passages of great artistic merit, I therefore describe the work as a whole as, quote, sadly marred by a sectarian bias, devotional extravagance carried almost to the point of frenzy, and social orthodoxy in its more repulsive form, unquote. This description did nothing to endear me to the Hindu members of the governing body at the time, and was now partly responsible for the fierceness of their opposition to Vallisinna's proposal. Though disappointed that I was not, after all, to occupy the editorial chair of the Society's journal, I was not discouraged. As Vallisinna pointed out, my position was no worse than his had been. I was a member of the editorial board. The other board members, himself excepted, would take little or no interest in the actual production of the magazine, though they might criticise it afterwards. And I would be left to do all the work. I was quite ready to do all the work, even though I would not be doing it now as editor, but only as one member of an editorial team whose existence was confined to the inside front cover of the Mahabodhi Journal. My only real worry was that the governing body might try to restrict my editorial freedom. Some of them, I knew, wanted to make sure I did not send articles direct to press from Kalimpong without them being seen and approved by one of themselves. But I was willing to take an optimistic view of the situation, and therefore continued to absorb myself more and more deeply in the work of implementing my plans for the improvement of the magazine. I was not so deeply absorbed in the work, however, as to have no time for anything else. For pilgrims coming from the Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, Calcutta was the gateway to Bodh Gaya and the other holy places of northern India. The headquarters building was therefore a busy place, especially during the winter months, and it was inevitable that I should sometimes meet people. Among the people I met was U Tain Maung, the Chief Justice of Burma and a leading Buddhist of that country, to whom the Society subsequently gave a public reception. Deva Priyaji, as Vallisinna was generally called by his friends and colleagues, also took me with him whenever he went to meet distinguished Buddhists who were passing through Calcutta, but not staying at the headquarters building. In this way, I met Jigme Dorji, whom I had last seen standing white-faced and horror-stricken beside his father's body, and the Maharani of Sikkim. The Maharani was, of course, the mother of the Maharaj Kumar of Sikkim, the Society's president. I had not met her before, but I had heard quite a lot about her, mainly from my old friend and supporter Marco Pallas, who was never tired of singing her praises as the most beautiful, intelligent, and vivacious woman one could possibly hope to meet in Sikkim or anywhere else. That must have been some years ago. Now the Maharani was a stout, elderly woman of considerable charm, but with only the remains of beauty. Her story was, I knew, a sad one. The mother of five children by the Maharaja, She had formed a connection with an incarnate Lama from Tibet, and as a result, had given birth to a daughter, now nearly grown up. This had led her to being banished to a palace outside Gangtok, where she lived in seclusion, taking no part in public life. Though she was separated from the Maharaja, they were not divorced. He was said to be still quite fond of her, and she retained the title of Maharani. Was it my imagination, or did I not detect a hint of melancholy in her expression? She received us very graciously, but declined to visit the society, probably on account of the equivocal nature of her position. Dr. Irene Basto Hudson, MD, could never have been beautiful, and charm and grace were not the first words that sprang to mind in connection with her. Intellectual rather than intelligent, and despite her 70-odd years possessed of demoniacal energy, she was a Canadian Buddhist-cum-theosophist who had arrived in Kalimpong the previous summer with a letter of introduction from an old friend of mine in England. Though eccentric and opinionated, she was of a generous disposition. Joe, who had known her by reputation in Canada, maintained that she tried to buy people. And after her return to Canada, had sent me two very welcome parcels of English classics, Spencer, Addison, Burns, and others. Some volumes being school prizes she had won towards the end of the last century. She also agreed to finance the publication of a collection of my poems, the final proofs of which had already reached me from the Bombay publishing house that was bringing it out. Now she was back in Calcutta and staying at the Grand Hotel, where I very soon had the opportunity of thanking her for her generosity. She had more or less decided to settle in Kalimpong, she told me over a cup of tea, and would go there as soon as her luggage had been cleared. Meanwhile, there was a lot she could do in Calcutta. For one thing, she could visit the headquarters of the Mahabodhi Society. This she accordingly did the following afternoon, staying on for my weekly lecture on practical Buddhism for the layman, and attending the Paritrana, or protection ceremony, that Aniruddha and I conducted in the temple afterwards. Not that the elderly Canadian Buddhist-cum-theosophist was the only Western visitor to the headquarters building that winter. Quite soon after my arrival, I received visits from Dr. Weintraub, a devotee of Anandamayi, Ma, who had spent 3 weeks at the Hermitage the previous year, and Mr. Damecki, a Pole whom Anicarika Dhammarakshita, Miss Delanoy, had put in touch with me. How Dr. Weintraub came to be staying at the Hermitage is something of a mystery. Probably he was simply escaping the heat of the plains. Whatever the reason may have been, so intense was his devotion to the Bengali woman mystic, that although he had intended to stay much longer in Kalimpong, he announced, after only 3 weeks, that he was unable to bear the pain of separation from her, and was returning to Benares forthwith. He was still in Benares, living at Andamai's ashram and visiting Calcutta for a few days, when he had heard that I was in the city. From the way he spoke, it was clear that he was as devoted to Andamai as ever, and in fact quite besotted with her. I could not but be reminded of my own contact with the blissful mother more than 5 years earlier, when I had been shocked and disgusted by the scenes of hysterical devotion that were sometimes enacted in her presence. Mr. Damecki, as I had gathered from the Anigarika's letter, was not a devotee, but an intellectual, and we had a long conversation on Buddhism, yoga, and similar topics. The Society's most distinguished Western visitors during this period, however, were Professor and Mrs. Franklin Edgerton, whom I showed round the temple with David Priyaji and Dr. Soft. Professor Edgerton was the author of the newly published Grammar and Dictionary of Buddhist Hybrid Sanskrit, and had recently delivered a series of lectures entitled Buddhist Hybrid Sanskrit Language and Literature in Benares. Among the people whom I met at the headquarters building, or who came to see me, was one who was neither a Buddhist pilgrim nor a Western visitor. This was Pani Bhusal Sanyal. I'd met him at the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture in 1945, when I was in the army and he a graduate student, and sometimes accompanied him on his weekly visits to the shrine of Sri Ramakrishna's saintly consort, popularly known as the Holy Mother, to whom he was greatly devoted. Now I was a Buddhist monk and he a professor of economics at a nearby Anglican missionary college and still unmarried. We had re-established contact shortly after my ordination as a bhikkhu, and he came to see me whenever I was in Calcutta, usually bearing a gift in the form of two or three slender green sticks of tuberose, of whose fragrance he knew I was particularly fond. A textbook example of an ectomorph, and light-skinned even for a Bengali Brahmin, he invariably came dressed in a white shirt and dhoti, with, in winter, a dark chadar or shawl elegantly draped, and wearing on his feet the black patent leather pumps of the babu, or gentleman. In the course of my present visit to the city of Anagarika Dharmapala and the Mahabodhi Society, as Calcutta was to me, or of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, as it was to him, he came to see me not once,